I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. On this archive edition of Midday, my guest is longtime New Yorker staff writer Adam Gopnik. He's written essays, profiles, reported pieces, art criticism, children's books, even the lyrics for two musicals. His latest book is an impassioned argument for liberalism. It's an account of how the liberal tradition began and how it has evolved in America and around the world. Far from a dry treatise on political theory, Gopnik's book is an elegant, compassionate call to action for fairness, equity, and reform that is premised in reason and empathy. It's called A Thousand Small Sanities, The Moral Adventure of Liberalism. Our conversation was recorded earlier, so we can't take your calls and emails. Adam Gopnik joins me right after the news. And welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Before we get underway today, I want to give a big shout out to everybody who joined us last night in Frederick at the Flying Dog Brewery. We had a great time at the Freedom Reads series. I was very honored to be asked to make a few comments about the First Amendment. Really enjoyed meeting Jim Caruso. He is the CEO of the Flying Dog Brewery and the founder of the First Amendment Society. His colleague Aaron Weston was terrific and very helpful in getting the event together. We also worked with the folks at the Frederick County Libraries, Brian Hissung, so we really appreciate that and appreciate all of our friends and colleagues here at WYPR for having a wonderful event. Heidi Shepherd and her staff did a great job. So we really had a good time down at the Flying Dog Brewery. If you've never been there, it's in Frederick. I strongly encourage you to go and check it out. Not only is the beer good, but it's a really interesting place to see. Beautiful spot right outside of Frederick. So we had a great time, and thanks to everybody who joined us there. We very much appreciate it. My guest today is Adam Gopnik, who has been a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine for the past 33 years. His new book is an homage to liberalism, in which he explores its roots in Montaigne and the Enlightenment and traces its history through the present day. He observes that liberalism was preceded by humanism and an affection for and elevation of a sense of community forged around shared choices. He calls it a fact-first philosophy with a feelings-first history. While most people associate liberalism with a left-leaning worldview, to Gopnik's eye, it ends in the center, although it's not to be confused with centrism, and he distinguishes it not just from a conservative orientation on the right, but also from the more radical left. It favors reform over revolution, and it is premised in love and empathy. Gopnik writes that liberalism is, quote, a belief that the sympathy that binds human society together can disconnect us from our clannish and suspicious past. The book is called A Thousand Small Sanities, The Moral Adventure of Liberalism. I found it incredibly compelling, original, and persuasive, and I am delighted to welcome Adam Gopnik to the show. He joins us from the studios of NPR in New York. Adam, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. What a lovely intro. Thank you.
Well, I was very, very taken by this book. I just thought it was persuasive and compelling in so many ways. And just it was original. And that was one of the things. I mean, one of the great things about this gig is I get to read a lot of books, but few of them affect me as strongly as this one. I mean it very sincerely. And listeners, without hesitation, I recommend that you run out and buy several copies of it. But I want to start by this notion of the distinction between liberalism and centrism. It's interesting that you say liberalism ends in the middle rather than on the left. How come?
Well, it seems to me that when people talk about centrism, Tom, they mean a belief that some might hold that the solution to every problem can be found in the middle. If I take a little bit of something from the right and a little bit of something from the left, I end up in the wishy-washy middle, and that's where I ought to be. My point is that the great tradition of liberalism often begins with enormously ambitious programs of social reform. I begin the book, as you know, talking about the great John Stuart Mill and his great teacher and lover, Harriet Taylor, and how those two people, who are core to the liberal tradition, had hugely ambitious ideas for the complete emancipation of women, for the coming of complete freedom to speak about any subject, including religion, without being censored. But they accepted that they were only going to be able to advance those very radical ideas through the process of persuasion. So when I say at one point in the book that, you know, that the reason the piazza in an Italian town is in the center of town is not because that's the best part of town, but that's the part of town everyone can get to. And in the same way, the reason that liberalism often ends in the center is not because the center is necessarily the best place, but because it's the best available place. The end of liberalism isn't just to declare rhetorical positions, but to actually make real change happen. And that involves recognizing that there are other people in the world who have opinions not like your own, and that you're going to have to make coalitions with them, compromise with them. And as I say, a compromise is a knot tied tight between two competing decencies. That's why liberalism ends in the center, not because liberalism is centrism.
You write that the opposite of humanism isn't theism, but rather fanaticism, and that the opposite of liberalism isn't conservatism, but dogmatism. So is there no dogmatic dimension to the liberal ideal?
Well, every view that we have, I suppose, rests on some irrational or not entirely justifiable axioms. It's certainly the case that liberals, like myself, like the many heroes and heroines who I try to profile in the course of this book, prefer nonviolence to violence, prefer generally shared prosperity to inequality, and prefer peaceful societies to violent societies. There are people who don't. There are people who genuinely prefer violent, exciting, heroic societies to peaceful, broadly prosperous societies. So in that sense, there's a dogmatic aspect to liberalism, certainly, Tom. You begin with those axioms. But I do think that historically, and even more important than historically, practically, as we try to live it now, liberalism asks us not to be dogmatic about, or to be as little dogmatic as we possibly can be, to learn the real lessons of history, which is that the search for the good, the search for the perfect, the search for the utopian solution nearly always, indeed always, ends in some kind of a disaster. And that instead of searching for utopian solutions, dogmatic solutions, following absolutist ideologies, we ought to embrace wholeheartedly and even heroically the possibility of pragmatic change, what I call radicalism of the real. That's what liberals are. They're radicals of the real.
And in what way are they radicals of the real? I mean, in, you write about how if, in fact, fanaticism is the chief enemy of humanism, fanaticism in political discord and in political life is the chief enemy of the liberal idea. Is there a distinction between fanaticism and absolutism, both on the left and the right?
They come to much the same thing in sort of in cash value, I think, Tom, that fanaticism and absolutism. Right wing tends to be more absolutist in the sense that right wing authoritarians like the kind that we are enduring and experiencing right now tend to like absolutism. Because I say it, it must be so. Whereas I think you could probably say that the leftist temptation is more towards fanaticism. I am in possession, or we are in possession of the one truth about class and life and the world, and we will not tolerate anybody who argues with us. But, you know, talking about radicals of the real, one of the things, as you know from reading it, that this book tries to do is to turn abstractions into concrete particular people. And one of the people who I talk about in this book is an example of what I mean by a radical of the real is the great and now somewhat sadly forgotten civil rights leader and activist, Bayard Rustin, who was both gay and African-American at a time when gay men didn't have a very large place or weren't accepted easily in the civil rights movement. And what Rustin did was to organize, among many, many other things, was to organize the March on Washington, for the March on Washington, which Dr. King could speak at. And what he had to do in order to organize it, because everyone agreed it was a great idea, it just wasn't going anywhere, was to sit in a room in Harlem with a bunch of young people and talk about how you charter buses to arrive on Friday night and get out by Sunday morning, how you make enough sandwiches for everybody at the Lincoln Memorial to eat. You know, I could have called this book A Thousand Small Sandwiches in honor of Bayard Rustin. He was devoted He said at one point, Dr. King is a saint, but he couldn't organize vampires to go to a bloodbath. And he understood that that kind of necessary pragmatic action, that without that kind of realism about what was going to be essential to actually making the march work, then the march was just going to be a dream. And I admire him hugely for exactly that reason, for him being able to take an ideal, a wonderful ideal, and turn it into something practical, something that would actually walk on its feet in the most literal way. And sometimes Rustin is claimed as a hero by people on the left, and certainly Rustin for a long time was a socialist, and proudly so. But as I point out in the book, and I have, I think, a wonderful quote from one of his letters, he was resolutely anti-communist throughout his life. He recognized in ways that not everyone on the left did that that model of Marxist dictatorship was a catastrophe and one that progressive-minded people had to avoid. So he showed very clearly that it was possible to be totally committed to radical, positive, progressive social change without falling into the trap of fanaticism. And that's why he's one of my liberal heroes.
Yeah, and your section on Rustin is really fascinating. Another section concerns the evolution and the process that developed the sewer system in London. This seems to be another kind of thing of this radical realism because, you know, they ended up with something that was ultimately very much to the common good. Talk a little bit about that.
I'm glad you enjoyed that part. That writing that part about the sewers was for me, you know, I'm a reporter by training, so doing that kind of reporting, even if it's archival reporting, gives me a thrill. Very much about one of the great forgotten liberal figures of 19th century England, a man named George Henry Lewes, who was the husband, the common law husband, we would say, and the great support of the life of the matchless novelist George Eliot, Mary Ann Evans, to use her given name. And Lewes, along with many other figures of the time, recognized that one of the things that was making life so horrific for the London poor particularly was what they called then a miasma. And it was a kind of a toxic fog that would rise from the Thames River every year. And it was the consequence of untreated raw sewage. And they saw that the necessary program of liberal reform, one of them, was to build a damn sewer. To build something on sufficient scale, engage in public works, use public funding on public works, a thing that in its day was still extremely controversial, in order to end the cholera epidemics. And so this simple, not merely modest, but in many ways embarrassing enterprise, because they had to involve themselves, engage themselves with the details of how sewage is made, how it flows, how it floats, and how you stop it, saved tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, by example, perhaps millions of lives. It's what I call the liberalism of process. That is an understanding that there's a liberalism of ideas and of great principles, but there's also a liberalism that involves saying we have to build unostentatious, seemingly modest projects. But if we do that, and that's where the title of the book comes from, if we can construct 1,000 small sanities, we can resolve and cure the most noxious social problems, cholera epidemics, through our common effort.
And it is, in that way, a kind of an incremental movement. I mean, you talk about the preference of liberals for reform over revolution. But isn't revolution called for from time to time when slavery, for example, is a problem that needs to be addressed by a society?
Absolutely. I think that's a terribly important point, Tom, that I sometimes fear being misunderstood about. Perhaps I didn't write it as clearly as I might have. That's always a risk, though I think I did.
I'm the first to admit I probably just understood it in the wrong way. Reform as preferable to revolution is interesting. Yeah.
Let me address it. There are lots of things that we all want in the world that we do not want to wait for. There's no virtue, I think, inherent in incrementalism. As you know, if you read my stuff in The New Yorker, I feel passionately, maybe at times too passionately, about causes like ending mass incarceration or, above all, gun control. That's something that I've written about over the past 30 years at endless length, over and over again. If I could have my way, we would have Canadian-style gun control throughout America tomorrow morning. I see no virtue in slowly developing incremental solution to that problem. I want it solved at once. But I recognize that my desire and my conviction of that isn't magically going to end it unless I get for myself autocratic power, which would create even worse problems in the long run if anyone could have autocratic power. So I recognize that the business of finally getting gun sanity in America is going to be a long and torturous and difficult one. It's going to proceed constituency by constituency. It's going to involve steps forward and getting pushed back. But we will get there. I believe that we can get there. That's where incrementalism comes in. It's not that incrementalism going slowly is good in itself. It's that if we're going to be radicals of the real, we recognize that if we accept pluralism, if we accept the reality that there are lots of different views in a society and all of them demand to be respected, if we accept that, then incrementalism is a consequence of our embrace of pluralism. But let me also address your question about reform and revolution. I think everyone recognizes that there are moments in human history, there are moments in human life when we have no choice. You chose the perfect one, the one that resonates most deeply in the American consciousness, and that's the Civil War and the abolition of slavery. At a certain point, it became plain that there was no place here for compromise, although Abraham Lincoln sought one right up to the brink of the firing of the weapons in Fort Sumter. That's one of the reasons why one of the heroes of this book is Frederick Douglass, who I think is the greatest American who ever lived. And Douglass, if you recall, a Marylander, was simultaneously a kind of radical prophet who said correctly, slavery isn't in need of reform, it's in need of abolition, absolutely. But who also, finally, given the choice, decided to range himself alongside Lincoln and constitutional politics in order to resolve the disaster, the moral scandal of slavery. Douglass, very much in isolation in many ways amongst the abolitionists, embraced the American Constitution. He said the Constitution is a wonderful liberty document. It simply hasn't been fully realized yet. So in that sense, choosing the path, yes, certainly, of war, but choosing it through constitutional means and democratic measures was part of the heroism of Douglass's life.
Adam Gopnik is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He's written a bunch of books. His newest one is a gem. It's called A Thousand Small Sanities, The Moral Adventure of Liberalism. We'll have more with Adam Gopnik when we continue after a quick break. Our telephone number, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. Thanks for being with us. Coming up tomorrow, by the way, my guest will be Heidi Daniels. She's the president and CEO of the Enoch Pratt Free Library. So she'll have some summer reading recommendations, and she'll give us an update on the big renovation of the Central Library, which is pretty much complete at this point. Their grand opening is in September. Plus, theater critic J. Wynne Russick will review Welcome to Shakesville. That's at the Baltimore Rock Opera Society. That's coming up tomorrow here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Adam Gopnik. He's with The New Yorker magazine. His new book is called A Thousand Small Sanities, The Moral Adventure of Liberalism. You can join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWIPR. You can follow me on Twitter at @TomHallWIPR. Adam, let's go to the phones to Ellen in Baltimore. Ellen, welcome to the show.
Hi. It's just a thrill to speak to Mr. Gopnik. One of my favorite books is his Paris to the Moon.
Mm-hmm. Yep, favorite of mine
and,
as well.
I just have one question. It always struck me that liberals actually believe in some sort of positive view of human nature, and conservatives do not. And so I know you're not trying to make that distinction, but nevertheless, liberals believe in the positive nature of human behavior. And I'm just wondering, you know, kind of what you make of that.
All right. Thanks for the call, Ellen.
Thanks for mentioning Paris the Moon. You know, it's a popular book. my one really popular book, and as a consequence, many people still believe I live in Paris. I very often get, when I'm around, people say, well, why have you come back to America? Are you still living there? Though we left 19 years ago. That's a terrific question. To be honest, I would put it the other way around. I think that liberals, historically, tend to recognize the limitations of human nature. They accept that we're all extremely fallible. That's why, as you said at the start of the show, Tom, that I begin my little genealogy of liberalism with the great essayist Montaigne, who was the first person to say, we are totally divided within ourselves and we reject everything we desire and desire everything we reject. So I think liberals begin with an understanding of how cracked our foundations are, how fallible our natures are. Where they differ from conservatives, I think, who sometimes embrace that same deep human truth, is that liberals believe in the possibility of reform. They say, we can't make a perfect world, and if we try to make a perfect world, we're almost certainly going to make a worse world. But we can make a better world. We can say, what's happening right there, whether it's the horror of slavery or the subjection of women or the oppression of sexual minorities, we can say, that's cruel. That's wrong. That we can alleviate. That specific thing we can alleviate. So in that sense, though, I think liberals tend to have a skeptical view of human perfectibility. They have a positive view of human progress.
When you define liberalism, you have a wonderful paragraph about it on page 80 of the book, and it's a very elegant and eloquent sort of peroration on the various dimensions of liberalism. You begin with a hatred of cruelty, and you talk a lot in the book about sympathy and love and empathy. At one point, you say that liberals recognize the primacy of sympathy as social cement. And again, not to be absolutist about it, but it doesn't seem to me that you're saying that that means conservatives do not think that or do not recognize sympathy as and empathy as good things. But perhaps is this a matter of sort of primacy in the hierarchy of values?
Absolutely. One sneering reviewer said it reads like a Beatles song. He got all his philosophy out of a Beatles record.
You could do worse than a Beatles song.
Exactly. I actually have gotten all of my philosophy from Beatles records, as my kids will tell you. So I will embrace all you need is love. You say you want a revolution. Well, we'd all love to see the plan. I'll take all the last five records of the Beatles as the foundation for my philosophical views. But yes, I think it is a question of emphasis. Obviously, countless, innumerable people who range themselves on the conservative right are people capable of and deeply enmeshed in human sympathy and compassion. There are great Christian traditions of institutionalized compassion and so on. What I'd claim is that the liberal tradition is the one place where secular people, without laying claim to any particular path to salvation, say we should make sympathy and empathy and compassion central to our social lives. We should make those primary rather than emphasizing the role of tradition or trying to locate virtue in the family or in a traditional place. I should add to, because though, Tom, as you know, having read it, I deliberately didn't want to make this book a political platform. It's a credo. It tries to affirm timeless values rather than offering a counsel for this particular moment, though God knows I do that often enough in the pages of The New Yorker. I do think that a part of the crisis, the emergency that we're living through right now, is to see a form of conservatism that's largely stripped of that power for compassion, that celebrates cruelty, that delights in bullying. I find that the most disturbing possible evolution because it strikes at our deepest values. We can all differ. We all ought to differ about and passionately about the rights and wrongs of abortion or the rights and wrongs of how high the interest rate should be at the Federal Reserve. Those are arguments we can all have. National health insurance is an argument we can all have. Arguing about a cruelty, saying, well, I kind of like a guy who's cruel. Boy, that strikes right to me at the foundation of everything we try to share.
My guest is Adam Gopnik. His new book is called A Thousand Small Sanities, The Moral Adventure of Liberalism. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. You're right, Adam. In the book, you hardly mention Donald Trump. And putting him aside in terms of conservatism, you say that this new language of compassionate emotion, trying to think sympathetically about society, tends to favor, as we said, reform over revolution. But it also, you seem to be very optimistic when you say that if sympathy binds human society together, it has the power to disconnect us from our clannish and suspicious past. I mean, tribalism and that tension between a sort of what appears to be a human instinct or impulse to be with one's own, can that really be attenuated by sympathy and empathy?
Terrific question. Here's what I think. I think that the classic right-wing critique of liberalism, which is a very powerful one, says that to some degree it can't. We all have to ask ourselves the question, not just who am I, but where am I? How am I related? How am I situated in the world? And we all take enormous pleasure and satisfaction in belonging to clans, in sharing traditions, in being parts of extended families, in being parts of communities. And to the degree that liberalism seems to break apart traditional communities, that's one of the things that conservatives hold against it, and not wrongly. You know, it's funny, actually, one of the images I offer of the conservative critique of liberalism is set in Baltimore. You know that beautiful film by Barry Levinson, Avalon?
Sure.
Right. Wonderful film, and it's all about the breakdown of community by television and by consumerism and so on until the patriarch, the hero, is, if you remember, left alone in his room. That's the picture conservatives draw. What liberals do, they destroy coherent communities and they replace them with isolated and alienated individuals. That's a very powerful critique. What I would say in response to that is that in truth, if we look around at the world around us, liberalism and the liberal values, liberal democracies, also build new kinds of communities we had never seen before. You know, I live here in New York City and I can joyfully pass from part of Brooklyn, which is occupied by Hasidim, by Lubavitchers, who live in a completely coherent community that's totally tolerated. And right next door, there are communities of hipsters. You often can't tell the two groups apart, the Lubavitchers and the hipsters, because they all have short beards and wear hats. That's part of what liberalism makes, the possibility of having plural communities, of having new kinds of communities that we hadn't seen before. And that, I think, is the liberal response to that very fair attack that says that we can, the pursuit of individual happiness can destroy the deep human need for coherent community.
And you talk about how human happiness is eccentric. We each have our own eccentric notion of what makes
exactly.
us happy, and how communities are forged around shared choices. But it's not necessarily the case that each of us needs to make the same choices in order to have a community.
That's right. I mean, they don't all have to be traditional choices. One of the beautiful things about liberal democracies is that they make, as I said a moment ago, new kinds of communities. That's why generations of Midwestern kids fled to Greenwich Village so that they could live in a community where they could felt that they could express themselves. Every summer, I spend a lot of time in Provincetown in Massachusetts, and it's extremely moving to see community made there largely or in large part of gay men and gay women who have made a coherent community for themselves, struggled to make one over the years. That's not something you'll find in a traditional society, but it's exactly the kind of pluralistic community that liberal democracies and liberalism are extraordinarily adept at producing.
When you define liberalism as a fact-first philosophy with a feelings-first history, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean by it specifically that if you look at the lives of the great liberal thinkers and the great liberal actors and the great liberal activists, they tend to be far from being kind of dry or procedural. They tend to be alight with romance and excitement. I start the book, as you know, with that wonderful couple I mentioned before, John Stuart Mill and Harriet Taylor, a British philosopher, his great love and the smartest human being he ever met. He also said Harriet Taylor. And they were courting clandestinely outside the rhinoceros cage in the London Zoo. And their story of how those great books that they wrote together on liberty, on the subjection of women came to be written wasn't a story of dry people kind of parsing contracts in a study. No, it was a story of two people who were wildly in love and whose political ideals were the consequence of the profundity of their passion. It was exactly because they saw in each other the chance for personal redemption that they dreamt of a broader social redemption for the rest of the world. Again and again in the story of liberalism, what we find are passions. What we find are people deeply, deeply stirred by original feelings who are convinced that we can make those positive feelings something that we all share. And that's what I mean when I say it's a fact-first history, a fact-first theory with a feelings-first history. Social contacts come before the social contract. And I think that that's something that people often forget when they talk about the liberal tradition. They forget how deeply rooted it is in passion and emotion.
Yeah, and that really is a fascinating observation. You say, for example, that we can't have faith in citizenship until we have confidence in our neighbors. We got to know people one at a time and trust them in order to build a community that makes us all confident that a citizenry can operate in a fair and equitable way. How does liberalism relate to humanism? You say that humanism is the thing that precedes liberalism. In what way and how important is what humanism brings to the table of liberalism?
Well, go back again to that great 16th century French essayist, a man therefore I'm very fond of, Montaigne. He wasn't really a liberal, a democrat. He didn't know anything about democratic politics. It was too soon. But he was a great humanist, and he understood that human beings, as I said before, are divided in themselves and that compassion and the fight against cruelty is central to what it means to be a human being. So that's the sense in which those humane values precede the way we might choose to organize our legislature. Before we can have a constitution, we have to have social compassion. That's what I mean when I say that humanism precedes liberalism. If you don't have humanism broadly shared, then having the greatest constitution in the world won't make a bit of difference. It's part of the tragedy of the rebuilding of Eastern Europe to learn that. If you don't have strong communities that have institutions of trust, not governmental institutions necessarily, or not even at all, then you're not going to be able to have free markets. Then you're not going to be able to have free elections. All of those things depend on the construction of communities, what is sometimes called by sociologists social capital. As a phrase that, as you know, I love that Frederick Law Olmsted, the great park designer, invented, commonplace civilization. If we don't have commonplace civilization, if we don't have First Amendment parties, if we don't have a volunteer fireman, if we don't have the habit of communicating with and collaborating with people who aren't our kin, then we can't have liberal democratic institutions. And tragically, as I say, the history of Eastern Europe and Russia after the fall of the Berlin Wall shows too dramatically how true that is.
Adam Gopnik is my guest. The book is called A Thousand Small Sanities, The Moral Adventure of Liberalism. We'll take a quick break, and when we return, we'll have more with Adam Gopnik. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR as well. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, we're discussing liberalism with the New Yorker staff writer Adam Gopnik. His new book is called A Thousand Small Sanities, The Moral Adventure of Liberalism. Gopnik writes, quote, liberalism has become passive, planetary, and private. It needs to become passionate, patriotic, and public-minded. What do you think of that statement? Do you identify as a liberal? And if so, what does liberalism mean to you? Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. So in terms of a prescription for the future, Adam, how can liberalism become more passionate, patriotic, and public-minded? How does that, what's that look like?
Well, you know, I was a little uneasy about trying to play the role of a pundit, as you know, it's not what I normally do. But I thought it was unfair. I wrote this book in some ways for my daughter, Olivia, as a kind of a letter on liberalism to my 17-year-old daughter. And it seemed unfair to sort of strand her without her specific recommendations. I think that we have to become more public-minded in the simplest possible sense. We have to struggle to invest in the public sphere. The simplest way, public education. You know, there's no social science more powerful than that, which shows that an investment in early education pays off better than any other kind of social investment we make. We have to be willing to make that kind of an investment. We have to be public-minded in the sense that we have to be, acutely aware of inequality in our society. We can't blind ourselves to that. Liberals must never be fatuous or complacent. That's what I mean by being public-minded. We have to be alert and conducting our own kind of moral accounting all the time, and we have to do it in every community. You know, a funny thing about this book, Tom, is that in some respects it began in Baltimore. I was giving the Cardin Lecture at Loyola, and I was asked to speak specifically about Jewish and Christian relations at that time. But I found that in order to do that, I needed to talk about what pluralism was, and it was that exploration of what real pluralism is, where tolerance begins, what tolerism must be, that this book really began.
It's interesting because you also talk about how the instinct of liberalism is rooted in a rueful admission of our own fallibility. And you talk about this, you know, fallibilism that is at the heart of liberalism, and you even say that that's the reason that Montaigne is the first real liberal. So what is the role of, you know, the recognition of our shortcomings?
Well, you know, I don't want to make it, you know, root this whole thing too much exclusively in the past. I think one of the things that we all find appealing about a contemporary politician, about the people we live with, is their ability to have some self-reproach, to have some self-analysis, to have a little self-irony. That's always a hugely attractive thing because it tells us that somebody realizes that the limits of his skin aren't the limits of the world. And I mean it in that sense, that we all need to be engaged in a kind of moral accounting. One of the things that I try and do in this book is do some moral accounting for liberalism, because I'm acutely aware that within the liberal tradition are lots of abuses and even some atrocities. The growth of liberalism in Europe and in America was allied to the growth of colonialism. Many awful things happened as a consequence. The one thing I think that liberalism does and has to continue doing is to insert what I call a corrective conscience into the heart of its institutions. We have to not just occasionally try to do a reckoning, but we have to make that reckoning part of our daily life. It's exactly the role that a free press plays. That's what a free press is there to be. It's there to be the corrective conscience of a liberal democracy. And to the degree that those kinds of liberal institutions stay strong, we can survive all kinds of terrible things. To the degree that those liberal institutions of the corrective conscience are weakened is the degree to which we may end up with a democracy, but it no longer will be a liberal one.
Adam Gopnik, the book is called A Thousand Small Sanities, The Moral Adventure of Liberalism. It's midday. Let's go to the phones to Frank in Baltimore. Frank, welcome to Midday with Adam Gopnik.
Hello. Good conversation. Just wanted to pass on to you two coupled stories. Back in the 1950s, my dad was a bus driver. He had to carry $65 in change with him. He was walking downtown. He became aware of a man following him, and he wheeled around and said, "You have to stop following me." And the man said in broken English, no, I just come to America. I come look for a job. And yesterday I come downtown, and you drive the bus to take me home. You take me home." And my father said, "Oh, in that case, I'm going to get a cup of coffee." Now, one would think that that was a story from the 50s, but then about 10 years ago, I was driving home, and an old woman on a hot day, I smiled at her, and she made a beeline in my car, and she got into my car and said, "You take me home. You look like a nice man." I bring this up because the view of the immigrant population is that America is this welcoming place, is this liberal place. That's what we're in danger of losing.
Well, thanks for that comment, Frank. I appreciate it. Adam, any response?
I couldn't agree more. You know, I am the grandson of first-generation immigrants from Russia and from Portugal, and their stories, of course, illuminate my own. I think that with all of the countless difficulties, imperfections, inequalities, wrongs that we can ascribe to liberal democracy generally and our liberal American democracy particularly, everyone has a story like that, or so many of us have a story like that to tell. I'd also add, you know, one of the touching things about that story, which I think is important, is to remember that those spontaneous acts of kindness and compassion and human engagement are not alien to us at all. In fact, they're quite natural to us. You know, I was giving a talk up in Boston not long ago, and a man in the front row as I was speaking had a heart attack, a seizure. It had stopped me talking, of course, but everyone in the front row rushed to the help and the assistance of this stranger. And I said at the end of the talk, that action is a much better demonstration of the principle of social sympathy that I think is at the core of the liberal dream than anything I can say today.
You talk about what we need to do as liberals looking forward is not find necessarily a middle way back to this notion of centrism, but a distinct way. What's the distinction between a middle way and a distinct way, and what kind of distinct way do you have in mind?
I think the distinct way of liberalism is the ability to passionately pursue a goal that you see as essential to progress, and at the same time have, exactly as we were talking about a moment ago, enough self-doubt and enough self-irony to recognize that your commitment to it is not enough to make it happen. I'll come back to the two things that I've felt most passionately about. Gun control is one, and the other is mass incarceration. I've written voluminously about both these subjects in some impotence. But I also recognize that my commitment to what I think of as gun sanity and gun control is not immediately persuasive to all of those Second Amendment fundamentalists with whom we're surrounded, and that I can't expect it to be. My desire for radical change won't produce radical change in and of itself. It's my job as a citizen to build a coalition of like-minded people that will eventually be able to do for gun crazy what we've already done for the most part for drunk driving crazy. That's been an extraordinarily successful social movement. And I know as a citizen that in making that coalition, and this is what I mean by a distinct way, that I'm not going to create that coalition through the vehement passion of my beliefs, but in making those beliefs appealing to a very broad range of people. And I've got to learn to speak a language that will appeal to a broad range of people, not just to those like me. That's the distinct way of liberalism.
And when you talk about that broad appeal, we have a tweet from John who says, liberal policies tend to poll very well, even with Republicans, but liberal candidates don't. Is this just a branding problem? What do you think?
Good question. I'll tell you a quick anecdote. My son Luke, who was one of the people I talked this book out with, took some time off from his studies to go to work for a candidate named Max Rose in a deep, deep red district in New York, the deepest red district, the only red district in New York City. And he had to learn to talk the language of patriotism and faith with people who needed to be addressed that way, who, in order to be treated with respect, had to be understood through that language in order to talk to them about all those progressive policies, healthcare, free tuition that your correspondent, the tweeter, is just talking about. And that was a lesson for my kid that he learned well, and it was a very valuable lesson for him to learn. So what do we have to do? Those policies are appealing to people. Liberal policies are appealing to people. The problem, I think, is not so much with the candidates themselves as it is with our own ability to leap past the limitations of our upbringing, our point of view, our background, in order to speak a broader language. The great liberal politicians, Barack Obama, LBJ with all of his limitations, were expert at doing that, were naturally good at doing that. And I have limitless admiration for people who go about the hard work of politics and the incredibly difficult work of making a language that can speak to all.
You do a great job in the book of critiquing the left's and the right's critique of liberalism. And on the right, one of the critiques is, you know, can sort of be summed up with the damned elites and their damned ideas on the left. It's a notion you refer to as triumphal authoritarianism. Mm-hmm. But you do say that there's a way for that, and it's largely anti-intellectual. We've certainly seen that not just in the current administration, but in prior Republican administrations. I think of the Bush antipathy towards, you know, stem cell research and that, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. But you say that it can become intellectually serious and even formidable. How?
Well, I mean by that that there's, as we were talking about before, Tom, the critique that says that by emphasizing educational advancement, you know, what's called a meritocracy above everything else, we deprive people of their own common identity. We deprive them of their experience. Educated people seem to be putting themselves on a superior plane, that creates enormous social resentment. And that social resentment is understandable. You know, you're ripping people's identities apart. You're not showing sufficient respect for their traditions, often for their faith. I think that that's a legitimate truth. And I think that those of us who think of ourselves as liberals have to pay attention to that need for identity. We can't wish it away. It's not going to go away. What we can do is to say that liberalism offers an enormous scope for identity. It offers an enormous scope for people to build their communities. They just have to make a commitment to pluralism. They just have to believe in tolerance of other people's communities to the greatest degree that's possible. So that liberalism's double appeal, both to building community and to the tolerance of other people's communities, I think is the core message that we want to offer and send.
Just have a couple of minutes left. Let's see if we can sneak in one more call. Let's go to George calling from Anne Arundel County. George, what's your quick question?
Thank you. Well, I'm wondering if your guest thinks that as seems to be the case in current American politics, that the ultimate goal of liberalism or in ultimate practice leads you to socialism.
All right. Thanks for that comment, George. And Adam, you write about this a lot.
I was about to say, I write at great length about this, and your caller might like to read that part of it, in which I try and say, look, there are lots of modalities through which you can economic solutions for problems. No one of them, I think, is especially privileged. There's certainly some things that where experience would try and tell you that what we call socialism is a good solution. There are lots of great socialist medical Medicare, like as in my native country of Canada. Other parts of human life don't seem to be well suited to government solutions. We don't have to have religious feelings about socialism versus capitalism. We have to ask ourselves, what works best? What's the pragmatic solution? Some parts of our life are going to need a state solution. Some parts of our life are going to need private solutions. I think we have to drain the drama from those words and recognize that there are lots of options possible in the world. Certainly, liberalism is compatible with socialism. It's also completely compatible with free market economics.
Well, Adam Gopnik, I very much appreciate your time and this terrific book. I really, really enjoyed it. So thank you so much and good luck with it.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's just really a pleasure to talk to you.
Adam Gopnik, he's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. The new book is called 1,000 Small Sanities, The Moral Adventure of Liberalism. That's it for us today. You can join us tomorrow. My guest will be Heidi Daniel, the president and CEO of the Enoch Pratt Free Library. She's got some recommendations for summer reading. Plus, we're going to talk about putting connectivity and high tech into some laundromats in a program that the Pratt is doing. Plus, we're going to hear from theater critic J. Wynn Russick. She's going to review the new show at the Baltimore Rock Opera Society. So that's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. Hope you can join us. Lunch today was provided by the Baltimore Chef Shop. They're on the Avenue in Hamden. They offer a variety of private events and cooking classes for kids and adults. This summer, the Baltimore Chef Shop will be offering classes in kitchen technique every Tuesday starting in July. Gift certificates are available, and you can get more information on the web at BaltimoreChefShop.com. I'm Tom Hall. Very much appreciate your joining us this afternoon and subscribing to our podcast. Thanks very much. Have a great day.